Chapter 22. Mounting an attendant grand trunk, nowhere, my Bathurstians and Darinan beg, of which I bought 2,000 for the account at 17 premium, down to Nix, my Juan Fernandez, my great central organs, prostrate. There was a moment when I thought I shouldn't be alive to write my own tale. Here follow in Mr. Plush's MS. About 24 pages of railroad calculations, which we pretermit. Those beasts, Pump, and Aljate, once so cringing and humble, wrote me a threatening letter, because I overdrew my account 3 and 6 pence. Wouldn't advance me 5,000 on 25,000 worth of scrip, kept me waiting 2 hours, when I asked to see the house, and then sent out Spout, the junior partner, saying they wouldn't discount my paper, and implored me to close my account. I did. I paid the 3 and 6 galleons, and never saw 'em more. The market fell daily. The rewind grew worser and worser. Hannies, Hannies, it wasn't in the city alone my misfortunes came upon me. They bearded me in my own home. The biddle who keeps watch at the Albany wadn't keep misfortune out of my chambers. And Mrs. Twiddler, of Pall Mall, and Mr. Hunks, of Long Acre, put execution into my apartments, and swept off every stick of my furniture. Wardrobe and furniture of a man of fashion. Apostrophe apostrophe what an advertisement George Robbins did make of it, and what a crowd was collected to laugh at the prose pick of my ruin. My chice plate, my cellar of wine, my pictures that of myself included, it was Marion, bless her, that bought it, unbeckoning to me, all went to the yammer. That brutal Fitzwarren, my ex-valley, whom I met, familiarly slapped me on the shoulder, and said, James, my boy, you'd best go into service again. Apostrophe apostrophe, I did go into service, the worst of all services. I went into the Queen's Bench Prison, and lay there a miserable captive for 6 mortial weeks. Miserable shall I say? No, not miserable altogether. There was sunlight in the dungeon of the poor prisoner. I had visitors. A cart used to drive up to the prison gates of Saturdays. A washywoman's cart, with a fat old lady in it, and a young one. Who was that young one? Everyone who has an art can guess, it was my blue-eyed blushing angel of a Mary Ann. Shall we take him out in the linen basket, Grandmama? Apostrophe apostrophe Mary Ann said. Bless her, she'd already learned to say Grandmama quite natural. But I didn't go out that way, I went out by the door a whitewashed man. Oh, what a feast there was at Healing the day I came out. I'd 13 shillings left when I bought the gold ring. I wasn't proud. I turned the mangle for 3 weeks, and then Uncle Bill said, well, there is some good in the feller, apostrophe, and it was agreed that we should marry. The Plush manuscript finishes here. It is many weeks since we saw the accomplished writer, and we have only just learned his fate. We are happy to state that it is a comfortable and almost a prosperous one. The Honorable and Right Reverend Lionel Thistlewood, Lord Bishop of Bullocksmithy, was mentioned as the uncle of Lady Angelina Silvertop. Her elopement with her cousin caused deep emotion to the venerable prelate. He returned to the palace at Bullocksmithy, of which he had been for 30 years the episcopal ornament, and where he married 3 wives, who lie buried in his cathedral church of St. Boniface, Bullocksmithy. The admirable man has rejoined those whom he loved. As he was preparing a charge to his clergy in his study after dinner, the Lord Bishop fell suddenly down in a fit of apoplexy. His butler, bringing in his accustomed dish of devil kidneys for supper, discovered the venerable form extended on the turkey carpet with a glass of Madeira in his hand. But life was extinct, and surgical aid was therefore not particularly useful. All the late prelate's wives had fortunes, which the admirable man increased by thrift, the judicious sale of leases which fell in during his episcopacy, and see. He left £300,000 divided between his nephew and niece, not a greater sum than has been left by several deceased Irish prelates. What Lord Southdown has done with his share we are not called upon to state. He he has composed an epitaph to the martyr of Bullocksmithy, which does him infinite credit. But we are happy to state that Lady Angelina Silvertop presented £500 to her faithful and affectionate servant, Mary Ann Hoggins, on her marriage with Mr. James Plush, to whom her ladyship also made a handsome present, namely, the lease, goodwill, and fixtures of the Heel of Fortune public house, near Shepherd's Market, Mayfair. A house greatly frequented by all the nobility's footmen, doing a genteel stroke of business in the neighborhood, and where, as we have heard, the butler's club is held. Here Mr. Plush lives happy in a blooming and interesting wife. Reconciled to a middle sphere of life, as he was to a humbler and a higher one before. He has shaved off his whiskers, and accommodates himself to an apron with perfect good humor. A gentleman connected with this establishment dined at the Heel of Fortune the other day, and collected the above particulars. Mr. Plush blushed rather, as he brought in the first dish, and told his story very modestly over a pint of excellent port. He had only one thing in life to complain of. He said that a witless version of his adventures had been produced at the Princess's Theatre, without with your leave, or by your leave, as he expressed it. As for the rest, the worthy fellow said, I'm happy perhaps betwixt you and me, I'm in my proper sphere. I envy my glass of beer port with your health and my service to you, sir, quite as much as my claret in my prosperous days. I've a good business, which is likely to be better. If a man can't be happy with such a wife as my Mary Ann, he's a beast. And when a christening takes place in our family, will you give my compliments to Mr. Punch, and ask him to be godfather? Letters of James. James on Time Bargings. Perhaps at this present moment of railway agitation and unsafety the following little history of a young friend of mine may act as an olasome warning to other weak and irresolute young gents. Young Frederick Timmons was the orphan son of a respectable clergyman in the west of England. Adopted by his uncle, Colonel T, of the Horse Marines, and regardless of expense, this young man was sent to Eton College, and subsequently to Oxford, where he was very nearly being senior wrangler. He came to London, to study for the law. His prospects was bright indeed, and he lived in the second floor in Jermyn Street, having a genteel income of £200 per annum. With this handsome annuity it may be supposed that Frederick wanted for nothing. Nor did he. He was a moral and well-educated young man, who took care of his clothes, polished his own tea party boots, cleaned his kid gloves with India rubber, and, when not invited to dine out, took his meals regular at the Oxford and Cambridge Club where, unless somebody treated him, he was never known to exceed his elf pint of Marsali wine. Merits and virtues such as his couldn't long pass unperceived in the world. Admitted to the most fashionable parties, it wasn't long before several of the young ladies viewed him with a favorable eye. One, especially, the lovely Miss Emily Milligatawny, daughter of the East India director of that name. As she was the richest gal of all the season, of course Frederick fell in love with her. His aspirations were on the point of being crowned with success. And it was agreed that as soon as he was called to the bar, when he would suddenly be appointed a judge, or a revising barrister, or Lord Chancellor, he should lead her to the altar. What life could be more desirable than Frederick's? He gave up his mornings to professional study under Mr. Bluebag, the eminent pleader. He devoted his evenings to elegant society at his club, or with his adored Emily. He had no cares. No debts, no extravagancies. He never was known to ride in a cab, unless one of his tip-top friends lent it him, to go to a theater, unless he got a order, or to enter a tavern or smoke a cigar. If prosperity was ever chalked out, it was for that young man. But circumstances arose. Fatal circumstances for poor Frederick Timmons. The railway operations began. For some time, immersed in lore and love, in the ardent occupations of his chambers, or the sweet society of his Emily, Frederick took no note of railroads. He did not recognize the gigantic revolution which with iron strides was awoken over the country. But they began to be talked of even in his quiet haunts. Even in the Oxford and Cambridge Club, fellers were a speculatin. Tom Thumper of Brazen Nose cleared £4,000. Semicolon Bob Bullock of Exeter, who had lost all his property gambling, had set himself up again, and Jack Deuces, who had won it, had won a small estate besides by lucky speculations in the share market. Everybody won. Why shouldn't I? Apostrophe thought poor Fred, and having saved £100, he began a written for shares using, like an economical feller as he was, the club paper to a prodigious extent. All the railroad directors, his friends, helped him to shares. The allotments came tumbling in. He took the premiums by 50s and 100s a day. His desk was crammed full of banknotes. His brain whirled with excitement. He gave up going to the temple, and might now be seen all day about Capel Court. He took no more interest in lore, but his whole talk was of railroad lines. His desk at Mr. Blueback's was filled full of prospectuses, and that legal gent wrote to Fred's uncle to say he feared he was neglecting his business. Alas, he was neglecting it, and all his sober and industrious habits. He began to give dinners, and thought nothing of parties to Greenwich or Richmond. He didn't see his Emily near so often. Although the audacious and misguided young man might have done so much more easily now than before. For now he kept a broom. But there's a terminus to every railway. Fred's was approaching. In an evil hour he began making time bargings. Let this be a warning to all young fellers, and Fred's huntumly and operate on them in a moral point of view. You all know under what favorable circumstances the Great African Line, the Grand Niger Junction, or Gold Coast and Timbuktu Provisional Atmospheric Railway came out 4 weeks ago. Deposit 9 pence per share of 20 L. 6 elephant's teeth, 12 tons of palm oil, or 4 healthy niggers, African currency. The shares of this illegible investment rose to 1-2-3 in the market. A happy man was Fred when, after paying down 109 pences, 3 L. 15s, he sold his shares for 250 L. He gave a dinner at the Star and Garter that very day. I promise you there was no Marsali there. Next day they were up at 314. This put Fred in a rage. They rose to 5, he was in a fury. What an ass I was to sell, apostrophe said he, when all this money was to be won. Apostrophe, apostrophe, and so you were an ass, apostrophe said his particular friend, Colonel Claw, K.XX.R., a director of the line, a double-eared ass. My dear fellow, the shares will be at 15 next week. Will you give me your solemn word of honor, not to breathe to mortal man, what I am going to tell you? Apostrophe, apostrophe, honor bright, apostrophe says Fred. Hudson has joined the line. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Fred didn't say a word more, but went tumbling down to the city in his broom. You know the state of the streets. Claw went by water. Buy me 1,000 Africans for the 30th, apostrophe cries Fred, busting into his brokers. And they were done for him at 478. ... Can't you guess the rest? Haven't you seen the share list? Which says, Great Africans, paid 90, semicolon price 14 par. Apostrophe, and that's what came of my poor dear friend Timmons' time barging. What'll become of him I can't say, for nobody has seen him since. His lodgings in Jermyn Street is to let. His brokers in vain deplores his absence. His uncle has declared his marriage with his housekeeper, and the Morning Herald, that amusing print, has a paragraph yesterday in the Fashionable News, headed Marriage in High Life. The rich and beautiful Miss Milligatawny, of Portland Plus, is to be speedily united to Colonel Claw, K.XXR. Jeems. Jeems on the gauge question. You will scarcely perhaps recognize in this little skitch asterisk the altered lineaments of one with whose face the readers of your valuable misogyny were once familiar, the unfortunate James de la Plutch, formerly so celebrated in the fashionable circles, now the poor James Plush, landlord of the Wheel of Fortune public house. Yes, that is me. That is my apron which I wear as becomes a publican, those is the checkers which ornament the pillows of my door. I am like the Roman general, Saint Senatus, equal to any emergency of Fortin. I, who have drunk champagne in my time, ain't now above drawing a pint of small beer. As for my wife, that angel I've not ventured to depict her. Fancy her a-sittin' in the bar, smiling like a sunflower, and, oh, dear Punch! Happy in nussing a dear little darlin' totsawatsi of a James, with my hair to a curl, and my eyes to a T. Asterisk this refers to an illustrated edition of the work. I never thought I should have been in just to write anything but a bill of gin, much less to address you on railway subjects which with all my soul I abhor. Railway letters, obligations to pay up, genteel inquiries as to my salicator's name, and C, I despise and scorn heartily. But as a man, an husband, a father, and a freeborn Briton, my duty compels me to come forwards, and express my opinion upon that national nuisance the break of gauge. An interesting event in a noble family with which I once very nearly had the honor of being connected, occurred a few weeks since, when the Lady Angelina S., daughter of the Earl of B. Cress, presented the gallant captain, her husband, with a son and heir. Nothing would satisfy her ladyship, but that her old and addict femme de chambre, my wife Mary Ann Plush, should be present upon this auspicious occasion. Captain S. was not jealous of me on account of my former attachment to his lady. I consented that my Mary Ann should attend her, and me, my wife, and our dear babby accordingly set out for our noble friend's residence, Honeymoon Lodge, near Cheltenham. Sick of all railroads myself, I wished to post it in H.A.N. 4, but Mary Ann, with the obstinacy of her sex, was bent upon railroad traveling, and I yielded, like all husbands. We set out by the Great Western, in an evil hour. We didn't take much luggage, my wife's things in the usual bandboxes, mine in a portmanteau. Our dear little James Angelo's, called, so in compliment to his noble godmama, Cradle, and a small supply of a few 100 weight of tops and bottoms, farinaceous food, and ladies' fingers, for that dear child, who is now 6 months old, with a prodigious appetite. Likewise we were charged with a brand new medicine chest for my lady, from Skivery and Morris, containing enough rhubarb, Daffy's elixir, Godfrey's caudle, with a few score of parcels for Lady Angelina's family and household. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.